So the basics of addiction. What I hope to accomplish today is to talk about what addiction ultimately may be. Because like most things in life, we kind of tend to think we know what it is until we start to see all kinds of ways in which what we think it is may not be and what we think might not be is. And I don't know about you, but I get confused by a lot of stuff. So one of the things that I want to do is start by basically just laying out some groundwork on what the problem of addiction might be. When a problem is a problem. And move from there to a model of looking at addiction that might be a little bit different than you've seen before, that places addiction into the realm of coping. And I'll come to that at the end. It's an interesting conceptualization of addiction that I think has an awful lot of promise for seeing addiction in a useful kind of way. Part of the motivation of this workshop is to provide something to our guys and the people who care about them that stands in contrast to the lived experience that many of us have. Many of us know someone whose brothers, best friends, cousins, uncles, dog walkers, doctors, niece was married to a guy whose uncle, once after 20 years, had his daughter come downstairs and see him open a beer and start to cry and say, "Don't drink, Daddy. Don't drink sleepy juice. I want to play." And he thought, "What am I doing?" And he poured it out, never thought about it again. Seems like these mythic figures live out there in the world. And anyone who struggles with addiction, I'm sure, has been told about someone who has this capacity, who has done this, who's poured it out, never given it another thought. And if they can do it, why can't you? Well, what I'm going to talk about in this workshop is why I believe that if that individual was able to pour it out and never think about it again, I'm not so sure that guy was an alcoholic. I'm not sure that that person had all the defining characteristics of addiction, at least from the perspective of the men that we meet and the struggles that we help guys to overcome here at MRTC. I'll come back to that. What I want to start with, though, is at its core, when is a problem a problem? How do you know when a relationship to drugs or a relationship to alcohol is a problematic relationship? Guy comes home every Friday night after work and he has to have a six-pack of beer every Friday night. Does that guy have a problem? Maybe no, maybe yes, I don't know. I mean, he's drinking once a week. What's it cost him? Guy's got some time to kill before he has to go back on shift. It's going to be about 4 hours until he has to work. Taking a bit of a break, decides to go sit in the bar and have a drink before he, 4 hours before going back to work. Does that guy have a problem? I don't know. That guy's an airline pilot. He's risking a $180,000 a year job over a drink. Maybe it's a problem. Is the guy who has a six-pack on Friday night, does that guy have a problem? Well, I don't know. If his wife explained to him for the 37th time, "Look, what you're not getting here is that I grew up in a family of alcoholics, and I can't be in this marriage. I know you're not getting drunk, I know you're not being abusive, but I cannot be in this marriage if you're drinking." And if in the face of that, he comes home and opens a six-pack and she says, "See you later," maybe that's a problem. Is a guy having a couple glasses of wine after work every night? Is that a problem? I don't know. His doctor says his health is fine. His relationship is fine. He's getting up for work in the morning. He's in the game. As a matter of fact, might actually even live longer given what some of the tannins are doing to his system. You can make some arguments about maybe getting the tannins from tea instead, but bottom line is, maybe it's not a problem. Maybe it's not about the pattern. Maybe it's not about the amount. Maybe it's not about the regularity. Maybe at its core, substance misuse becomes a problem when it's a problem. And these are my favorite definitions of addiction because it gets out of all the moralistic, well, you're relying on it, you're needing it, you're this, you're that. And it just really comes down to, okay, I understand that you're thinking that this is a problem or that you're thinking this is not a problem, let's look at how your life would be different if you didn't have drugs or alcohol in it. Let's look at what drugs or alcohol are costing you in your life and then see if you can afford it. If all it's costing you is a few bucks that you've got anyway, maybe it's not a problem. So where we start off in this definition of addiction or substance use or misuse being a problem is with the American Psychiatric Association, the big DSM-4, the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual. Basically, it is the book that psychiatrists, the medical profession, uses to establish when things are disorders, when things are issues. Addiction is seen as one of the mental health issues that we contend with out there. And so let's look to the mental health guys. And they talk about two different and distinct issues. One is the issue of a pattern of substance abuse. Substance abuse is defined as a maladaptive pattern of substance use. So it's excessive use or maladaptive pattern of use that leads to impairment or problems in work, social, kind of family, health, education, or high-risk activities. So people are diagnosed with a substance abuse disorder when they actually start to rely on substances, when substances start to occupy somewhat of a central point in their lives, such that it's creating a bit of a maladaptive pattern. It's starting to show up. There starts to be a cost. There starts to be a consequence. This is not necessarily the same as full-blown addiction. Many people with substance misuse problems or substance abuse problems are living quite functional lives. And some of the estimates of American college campuses suggest that probably about a third of the 18 to 24-year-olds enrolled in college in the States are displaying all the characteristics of a substance abuse pattern. Their grades are suffering, they're missing work, they're missing classes, the relationships are struggling a little bit, because basically they're partying. They're drinking more than's good for them. They're using more than's good for them. It's a problem because the family's on their case. It's a problem because the grades are suffering. It's a problem because perhaps they're engaging in some high-risk activities and high-risk behaviors, driving under the influence. Basically, their pattern of substance use has stepped out of a responsible kind of pattern and into the kind of pattern of using that's going to start to cost them something. Where you start to see this as diagnosable is around the way in which substances start to take a central point in people's lives. It's not a take-it-or-leave-it kind of relationship. And this is the same with full-blown addiction as it is with even substance abuse kind of patterns. And I think about a friend of mine whose little brother was going camping one weekend. So he and three buddies got together and they planned this camping trip. And they pooled all their money. And they realized that they had about $100, and there were four of them, that would probably be enough money for them to buy beer for their couple of days away. And one of them said, well, what about food? And they talked about it, and they came to the conclusion that beer is rather filling. So they probably should be okay. And so they went and they spent all of their money on beer, and, well, I think they bought some food. I think they bought a few bags of chips. And went camping for the weekend. This kind of, you know, food is what you get with the money left over after you bought the beer, is the kind of behavior that starts to push people into what could be diagnosed as substance abuse patterns. The more progressive substance dependence is basically the above, a substance abuse pattern, plus tolerance and withdrawal. And this is the point at which we start to come up with labels like addiction. We don't tend to call somebody an addict for displaying patterns of substance abuse. These are problematic patterns of using, but it's not quite the same as full-blown addiction yet. The mental health professionals would talk about full-blown addiction, once alcohol or drugs occupies that central point in somebody's life and you start to rely on or consume substances in such a manner that you develop tolerance. I used to be able to drink 3, then 6, then 12, then 24, and until I got up to a quantity that would kill most people. I mean, I've worked with clients who consume on a daily basis a quantity of alcohol that would kill just about everybody in this room if we tried to consume that quantity. They have consumed so long and so chronically that their bodies have adapted to it. And as a matter of fact, if they were to stop abruptly, the cessation of alcohol in their system without medical intervention could kill them. That's why we have detoxes. That's tolerance. If you can drink 60 beer and still stand, you have developed tolerance. And of course, if you wake up, you know, about 18 hours after your last beer, and you're trembling and you're sick, and the only thing that settles you down is more beer, that's withdrawal. And by the time you get there, very few people will argue about whether or not we're dealing with addiction. Substance use to be substance dependent, substance often taken in larger amounts or over a longer period of time than intended. There's a persistent desire or unsuccessful efforts to cut down or control the use. A great deal of time is spent in activities necessary to obtain, use, or recover from the effects. The important occupational, social, recreational activities are given up or reduced because of substance use. And the substance use is continued despite knowledge of persistent physical or psychological problems. So it's not just the problems are appearing in life, but you're confronted by the problems and choosing to use anyway. That is characterized as addiction. Now, I like that definition. I love both these definitions because they really put on the table, they get us away from these debates about how much is too much. It's a problem when it's a problem. If one beer on a Friday night is going to cost you your marriage, and you really want that marriage, and you find yourself unable to not have that beer, you have a problem. I don't care that it's just one. That's a problem. If you desperately want to save that marriage and you find yourself opening that beer, that's a problem. If you're cashing in your career over a couple of drinks, that's a problem. If you're just out partying with your buddies, but you're failing out of school as a result, yeah, there's a problem there, provided you wanted to be in school. I mean, it becomes a problem when it's a problem. It gets us away from these debates, and it gets us onto something tangible to work from. But there's something missing from both these definitions that it's kind of at the forefront of what the Americans are doing in terms of trying to push the field of addiction knowledge forward. And it's the notion of the obsessive compulsions around use. That's the one thing we're not seeing there. And the best way to describe this, the thing that might be the difference between buddies, uncles, cousins, dog walkers, best friends, doctors, nieces, husbands, whoever, who walked away from it and never gave it another thought, the difference between that guy and the man we work with here at MRTC typically comes down to this one thing, that kid. I'm sure everybody knows who I'm talking about, that kid. We've all heard her at the grocery store. The one about 6 years old that wants the candy, and mom's trying to say no, and mom's doing the best she can to say no, but the kid knows if I just grind hard enough, please, please, mom, please. I promise I'll eat my dinner, mom, please, please. Just one candy, mom, please. I'll be good and I'll clean my room. Oh, come on, mom. Why not? You're so mean. You're so mean, mom, please. Oh, look at that boy. That boy gets candy. How come he gets candy, Mom? Please? Please? That kid. You know that kid? That kid that, like, everybody in the grocery store wants to buy candy for? The one with the mom who looks like she's about to drink? Please? Please, Mom? I promise I'll never ask you for anything again. Please? Oh, come on, Mom, please. And after about 20 minutes of this, it's like, just somebody make this kid shut up. Please. And unfortunately, often what mom does is gives in, caves, makes the kid shut up, and when you do that, all you do is you teach the kid that you got to whine for at least 20 minutes to get what you want. And so the next time mom holds out for 30 minutes, and the kid just learns, I guess it's sometimes 30 minutes, not 20. etc. Please, Mom, just one drink, Mom. Just one. Come on, it's not like I'm buying. I'm just stopping with my buddies, Mom, please. Just one hoot, please. I'll be good. I got 60 days clean, Mom, please. It's okay now. I can handle it, please. Imagine trying to go through your life with that kid, not in your shopping cart where you can't get away, that kid in your head where you can't get away. Do you guys know anything about this kid I'm talking about? Ever met this kid? And after a while, all you want to do is just make the kid shut up, whatever it takes. I don't want to use, I just don't want to hear the kid. Imagine trying to go to work with this kid in your head. Imagine trying to have dinner with your family. Imagine trying to play with your kids. Imagine trying to make love to your wife. Imagine this kid in your head 24/7. And that's the characteristic of addiction that most of the men I work with talk about. That kid is crafty. But the core defining feature of that kid, the core defining feature of addiction, to me, are the obsessive compulsions around use. The difference between the guy who puts it down and never gives it another thought, and most of the guys I work with, is most of the guys I work with, when they put it down, the thought starts. The voice happens. Just one, please. Please, just one. I know I'm absolutely committed to recovery. Starting tomorrow. Please. Just one more. It's not like I'm buying. I'll be good. I'll work twice as hard, please. Those obsessive compulsions play out. And when you talk to people in the States, the sort of leading edge of addiction research in the States seems to be led from the neurologists and in the neurochemistry of addiction, Nora Vokow and people like that down at NIDA. And they talk about the stop center in the brain and the go center in the brain. The go center in the brain is the primitive kind of thing that moves us toward the things that we want or need in life. The go center in the brain would see the donut and say, donut, and push you toward the donut. It's like nutrition, calories, Boston cream. And then we all have the stop center in the brain. And the stop center in the brain is the rational part of the brain. The go center is the primitive kind of move toward the things that bring you pleasure. And the stop center of the brain is the part of the brain that says, it's the brakes. It's the part of the brain that says, hang on a sec here. That donut happens to be sitting in front of a 300-pound biker. Do you really want to go take his donut away? That could be the last donut you ever eat. And in a lot of the stuff that they've been doing, they've noticed that most of the guys we work with have go centers that are like Olympic caliber. If you tested our guys' go centers, you'd probably find steroids. And the stop centers, in terms of the capacity of our guys to step on the brakes, some of us have braking systems. It's like four-wheel, all-disc, you know, four-wheel disc, ABS kind of braking systems. Most of our guys, their braking systems are an awful lot like Fred Flintstone. You put your feet down, you hope like heck you stop. Many people with addiction, it's really characterized as an impulse control disorder, these obsessive compulsions, and in the face of this thinking, many of our guys don't have the kinds of capacities or tools or techniques to put the brakes on that maybe people out there have, the take it or leave it kind of scenario. It's a little bit of a different neurochemistry at its core associated with the obsessive compulsions. Now, I was thinking about it just the other day. My son is 4. And we took him trick-or-treating at Halloween. We did our little townhouse complex and half of the one next door. We were out for about half an hour, 45 minutes. And he had his last Halloween candy a couple days ago. On the days he could think of to ask for one of his candies, he'd ask for one of his candies, and then you haven't had your candy today. And he'd go and he'd get his bucket down, he'd have his one candy, and that would be it. And on a daily basis, when he thought of it, he could ask for one candy, and his Halloween candy lasted him 3 months. That doesn't tend to be our guys. Our guys are the guys who tend to come home after a day of trick-or-treating, covered in chocolate with an empty pillowcase, throwing up on the kitchen floor. In terms of addiction, his capacity, my son's capacity Now, I mean, this is not perfectly predictive, but my son's capacity to kind of meter things out like that, that kind of impulse control that he displays, bodes well for him in terms of substance misuse problems later on. It's kind of not the whole picture, but that kind of thing shows that some of the things maybe going on for him are a little bit different than many of the clients I work with. That there are some pieces around the neurochemistry, around the obsessive compulsions, that our guys have that are very different than other people. Now, in the face of these obsessive compulsions, in the face of the way in which substance misuse or substance dependence, substance abuse tends to occupy a central place in people's lives, a lot of the people that care about our clients really get lost in a lot of what happens around addiction. A lot of the people that we work with, the people who care about them, tend to feel like our guys have chosen drugs or alcohol over them. Like they come second. And to some extent, one of the defining characteristics of addiction is having the substance take the central point in someone's life. And it is for many of the guys I work with. Life is what you do with the time left over after you've taken care of the needs of your substance of abuse. Family is what I do with the time left over after I've taken care of getting what I need. And I got my paycheck, and now that I've taken care of what I'm going to need this week, I've got what I need to sort of live on. And everything kind of comes first, but that experience of choosing drugs or alcohol over family members. My husband chose drugs and alcohol over me. My son chose drugs and alcohol over the family. For most of the guys I work with, really doesn't seem to be the case. If only it were, things would be simpler. For most of the people I work with, the problem is not they've chosen drugs or alcohol over important obligations. It's that they put one foot down the path of addiction, but you know what? I still want to keep in this family. And a foot goes down that path. But I need to take care of my needs, because if I don't, I'm going to be sick. But I'm going to try to be there for Christmas, Mom, but I can't make it there for Christmas until I'm making sure I'm okay, especially if I'm going to be fighting with my sister. And guys try to put one foot down each path. And as you can see, it does not take very long before this really hurts. And you need help getting out of it. The problem is not choosing drugs or alcohol over important obligations in your life. The problem is guys try to go as far as they can down both. Until, like me, they've just gone too far. This pull of addiction, the obsessive compulsions, the shrinking focus. I mean, I think to some extent, all of us have these characteristics, and all of us have these characteristics at different times. If my doctor were to say to me, you know, you probably want to cut back on the chocolate cake, you probably want to get your cholesterol down, I may or may not have some difficult decisions, I may or may not have some struggles that I need to make in the face of that. But maybe I could be successful in just turning down chocolate cake. Maybe I could think about all kinds of things and use all kinds of techniques and just turn down chocolate cake. But I got to tell you, if I get stranded in the woods somewhere, if I get stranded on a desert island, if I get lost up one of the mountains, and I come out of the bush 10 days later, not having eaten in 10 days, and all that search and rescue has is a chocolate cake, what do you think my capacity for saying no thank you is going to be? And if I haven't eaten in 10 days, but you know what? No thank you. I'm trying to cut down on cholesterol. It's like, sir, kindly get your hand away from the chocolate cake. I don't want to take it as well. But if it's there, I probably will. I guess what I want to highlight is that what can't get lost in all of this is that the use of drugs or alcohol is and always is a choice. Addiction is not a choice. We didn't choose the brain chemistry that we were born with. We didn't choose often the trajectory our life started on. We didn't choose where and when we were born. We didn't choose our DNA. And I have yet to meet a guy in this treatment center who talks about choosing to be an addict. I've met a lot of guys who have made some choices around using substances that have led them places, but, you know, I have yet to hear somebody say, yeah, well, my grade 5 career day presentation, when I grow up, I want to be a drug addict. I like this thing called chaos, and I'm pretty good at it, and I think I have a lot to give the world in terms of, you know. I have yet to work with a guy who comes home and says to me, you know, well, I just came home one day and said to my wife, Wes, honey, the field of accountancy has gone kind of stale for me. I think I'd like to make a career choice, and I was thinking addict. I think I would like to sling dope and get bling, whatever that is. People don't choose addiction. They don't choose that darkness. They don't choose that craziness. What people do is they choose to use. Addiction is not a choice, but the use of drugs and alcohol is. And for many of our guys, the choice to use leads them to addiction. Most of the men I work with, maybe not all, but most of the men I work with, once upon a time, you're 15, 16, 18, whatever you were, once upon a time, you and the buddies were hanging out. And you were using alcohol, or you were using drugs, and you were using it for all kinds of reasons. You were using it to escape from the monotony at school. You were using it to escape from chaos in the family. You're using it to fit in. You're using it to be cool. You're using it because it was fun. You're using it because your buddies were using it. Whatever it is that got you into it, whatever it is that started your choice to use, most of the guys I work with talk about how me and my buddies one day, we chose to use. And we chose to use again. And one by one over the years, we continued to make that choice, except that one by one, my buddies started to get into relationships, started to get jobs, started going to school, got married, had kids, settled down, mortgages, cars. One by one, my guys, my buddies, my posse, they left the party. And I woke up one day at 35, loaded, wonder where everybody went. We all started using for the same reason. They stopped, I continued. And the reason I continued using was very different than the reason I started. Guys often don't choose to become addicts. They simply make a choice to use. And in the face of that choice to use, some of us have some underlying brain chemistry, some underlying capacity for obsessive compulsions. We all have these. For some of us, they're much more pronounced than others. Some of us, they're around certain substances. Some of us, they're not. I work with a lot of family members that just don't get the obsessive compulsions until they'll confess things like driving around Vancouver at 10 o'clock at night looking for a Dairy Queen that's still open because they got to get a peanut butter parfait. And I'm asking, is that really kind of a sane and rational thing to be doing? Well, in the face of it, but you know what? Those compulsions aren't causing them their marriage. Those compulsions aren't costing them their careers. Those compulsions aren't necessarily costing them their lives. I guess we all have compulsions. We all sometimes step down paths we'd rather not. But for our guys, the game's a little different. Did you have a question or comment?
Yeah, myself, I've recently been diagnosed with adult ADHD.
Mm-hmm.
One of the symptoms of which is terrible lack of any impulse control. And now, since I've been on medication, it's sort of like only being able to see in two dimensions, all of a sudden you can see in three dimensions. Like, all of a sudden I'm able to understand why my father's being so annoyed, because he's assumed that I've had this capacity to, you know, now I get an impulse to do something and I actually choose not to.
Yeah.
I didn't know that it was like that for most people. Whereas my dad, look, he's assuming that I have the choice not to, and I choose to do so. Whereas, like, that's just not the way it was. It's bizarre. It's like, I had no idea that most people's brains work that way. But I think that's what a lot of people don't seem to
understand.
It's not like you have an impulse and sit there and think, should I or should not? So you have an impulse and you're gone.
And a lot of...
If you decide to do something, it's done.
And a lot of undiagnosed ADHD... shows up in stimulant addiction as men discover through the use of stimulants that all of a sudden I can slow down and focus enough. I worked with a client who got through university on cocaine. Every time he needed to study, he'd do cocaine because it would slow his brain down enough that he could actually sit at his desk and focus and study and do well. And he graduated with a really high GPA and a major cocaine dependency issue. And then he discovered, you know what? Maybe there's other medications that don't cost me as much as cocaine in terms of what it was doing to my life. Absolutely. Absolutely. And so, in the face of it, people start using for all kinds of reasons. The issue is the way in which people get trapped. The addicts are the ones that get trapped down there. There are, on this planet, recreational methamphetamine users. I mean, we hear about the scourge of crystal meth and the propaganda that you can get addicted the first time you use it. The reality is there is an entire community of recreational methamphetamine users. I got to tell you, though, the vast majority of people who try to join their club end up here instead. For out of 100 guys who try to be recreational meth users, very few succeed. Most of them end up being MRTC clients. But they're out there. Some of us are born with an underlying brain chemistry this way, some of it that way, and you never know. I got to tell you, if I could invent any one machine, I'm rehearsing for the Miss America pageant right now. If I could invent any one machine to help better the planet, I would invent a machine in high school that gave everyone a brain scan and told them what substance would be problematic, what substance would hook them, and what substance wouldn't. I'd give the career testing, they'd fill in the bubbles, and it would come back, and the guy would come in, and I'd say, well, according to this, you can be a mortician or a circus clown. Those are your best professions, and you can drink alcohol, but stay away from cocaine and heroin. According to this, you can recreationally use any drug you want, and you're an accountant. According to this, you're best suited to be a used car salesman, and you need to stay away from alcohol, cocaine, heroin, amphetamines, mushrooms, acid, and my daughter. The reality is, all of us go through life with an underlying brain chemistry, and some of us, somewhere the estimates range between about 6 to 10% of us, have the underlying brain chemistry to set off these obsessive compulsions, the underlying brain chemistry of addiction. Some of us have it, some of us don't. And unfortunately, until I invent my machine, there's only one way to know if you have the underlying genetic predisposition to be an addict. You pick up the gun, you pull it, put it to your head, and you pull the trigger. And one of two things is going to happen. It's either going to go click, or maybe it'll go click a couple of three times, or it'll go bang. It may go click for the rest of your life. Have a glass of wine after dinner. Not a worry. Do a little bit of cocaine in the party scene. No problem. Click, 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 click. Lucky you. Most of our guys, however, our guys, all of our guys, are the guys who picked it up and it went either click, bang, or just went straight to bang. Many of our guys, from the first time I did it, I felt A, like I was home, and B, like I was in serious trouble. Because within seconds of that first feeling, the next feeling was, I got to get more of this. Bang. People don't choose to be addicts. They make choices around using. They make choices to pick up the gun, put it to their head, and pull the trigger. And unfortunately, we don't teach our kids about that gun, not in ways that are useful. We have these DARE programs that make parents and educators feel great, but the research says don't do anything in terms of prevention. They're useless. But we continue to offer them because I don't know why. And the reality is people are going to make the decisions they make, and it's either going to click, great, best of luck to you, or it's going to go bang, we got a chair for you. But I can't underscore enough that people don't choose to be addicts. Given that you discover that you have the underlying brain chemistry to earn you a seat here in the treatment center, given that you may discover that you don't have the kind of impulse control that maybe the rest of the population does, that some of the kind of obsessive compulsions, some of the kind of factors of addiction are in your brain and maybe not somebody else's, given that you've discovered the hard way that you need to be in a place like MRTC, it's not like you're doomed. It just means, you know, you can drive a car without brakes. You just have to drive it very differently. You can't drive in rush hour. You can't drive on the freeway. You shouldn't be doing 120 kilometers down low heat. You're probably going to want to do 15 with the hazard lights on, driving at night, anticipating three blocks ahead, always being much more mindful than the guy doing 120 on the cell phone eating a burger who happens to have four-wheel anti-lock brakes. Using drugs or alcohol is a choice. It's always a choice. I have yet to work with a guy who's managed to get loaded in a way that was not a choice. One of my favorite definitions of addiction is just making the same damn bad choice over and over and over again, regardless of the consequence. Knowing where I'm going. This time will be different. Making that choice, ended up in the same place. So why don't addicts choose to not use? Is it an issue of weak character? Well, I don't think so. I think, again, the thing I tried to highlight is that we all have to make choices around using drugs or alcohol. The choice that one of our guys has to make in the face of his drug of choice is probably not the choice I have to make. Probably not the choice that many of the people who care about you guys have to make. Probably the best example of this was a guy and his wife. They would go out for dinner together. They'd both have wine. She'd drink half of her glass of wine. He'd drink the rest of the bottle. She'd leave half the glass of wine on the table. She'd had enough wine. She enjoyed it. It was pleasant. But that was all she wanted. And they'd walk out of the restaurant. And it's not like this guy didn't have access to alcohol. They were going home. And when they got home, he was going to open a couple more bottles of wine and drink. He had like all the wine he needed for the night. But as they're walking out of the restaurant, he's thinking of that half a glass of wine sitting on the table. He's getting irritated on the drive home because he can't get the image out of his head of that half glass of wine that was left on the table. Wasted. Even though he's going home to a bottle of wine that he's going to open and drink and she's done for the evening, he can't get it out of his head. It got so bad that she'd drink half a glass of wine. They'd be leaving the restaurant and he'd go, "Oh, honey, I forgot my whatever at the table." He'd run back to the table and finish the glass of wine. Not because he needed it, but simply because it was the only way to get the obsession out of his head. Now, when you ask each of those people to make a choice to not drink a glass of wine, it is a choice for both of them as to whether they'd say yes or no thank you to a glass of wine. But I'm hard-pressed to believe that the kind of choice that each of those people has to make is the same choice. If his head goes to that obsessive place over half a glass of wine left on a table, my hunch is that his capacity to say no, the struggle that he's going to have to make to choose not to drink, is going to be very different than her, who's just going to say, "Oh, no, thank you. No, I just don't feel like any tonight." Addiction, the use of substances, is and always is a choice. But for all kinds of factors, from a neurochemical perspective, from a social perspective, all kinds of factors come into play to make these choices very different between the men that we serve here at MRTC and people who don't struggle with a problem. And again, it's not like all hope is lost. It just means if you have different struggles, you probably need different tools, a different repertoire, a different way of choosing to use or choosing not to use, and some different tools to pull you away. So, I'm going to move quickly to the final kind of piece I want to talk about, and it really is a piece around locating addiction in its proper place. One of the things I hear all the time is people will ask me, "Well, what's more addictive?" I love this question. What's more addictive, heroin or cocaine? What's more addictive, tobacco or alcohol? What's more addictive, shopping or Twinkies? What's more addictive? As if addiction is a property of a substance. I mean, the chemists have got the chemical composition of methamphetamine all worked out. They know all the ingredients that go into methamphetamine, and none of the ingredients include addiction. If you look at the molecular structure of cocaine, there is no addiction in cocaine. There is no addiction in heroin. Addiction does not live in a substance. Addiction lives in a person. We tend to talk about drugs or alcohol or activities as if they're addictive. And the work I'm talking about now is a work from a guy by the name of Stanton Peale. He's an American researcher. He's pretty cutting edge down in the States. Not so much here. We're probably maybe 15, 20 years ahead of the Americans in terms of a lot of our conceptualizations of addiction and recovery. And Stanton Peale, he really does a beautiful job of locating addiction, not as a property of a substance, but as a property of an individual. And if you locate addiction not in the drug, but in the individual, it really changes your perspective around what treatment is and needs to be. You can't tell who's going to become addicted and who's going to quit from a brain scan. At least not today. I haven't invented that machine. Well, I guess the best place to start is in appreciating how it is that we can have some pretty good evidence, for instance, that heroin in and of itself is not addictive. In and of itself. Once upon a time, in the not too distant past, mid-60s and earlier, addiction was for the most part an issue of character. It was a moral issue. People just didn't have the solid moral character to make better choices. They were weak. Addiction, as a matter of fact, went beyond that and it was a crime. The man who founded Maple Ridge Treatment Center, Wolf Jourdain, was arrested in Maple Ridge for the crime of public drunkenness and sentenced to a correctional facility not far from here, I think for a period of 30 days. And he came out of this correctional facility 30 days later and went, well, that was totally not useful. At that point, addiction was not seen as any kind of a mental health or a health issue. It was an issue of character. And Buddy's got poor character. He's drunk in public. Let's send him off to jail for a month and smarten him up. And he came out of jail and he went, this is insane. And so he opened his home to men in the community who were struggling with alcohol and started what would have been a very rudimentary support recovery facility, which has transitioned over 40-some-odd years into the largest residential treatment center in the province. But in that day, in Wolf Jourdain's day, addiction was a moral issue. And we don't spend a lot of money, governments don't spend a lot of money on morality and on issues of researching morality. And so really there wasn't a lot of money being spent by the governments on addiction treatment and on addiction research until an event in the late 1960s, early 1970s in the United States got the attention of the American government. Any idea what was going on in the late 60s in the States? The Vietnam War. I would have loved to have been in the Oval Office, fly on the wall, watching the news be delivered. The Americans sent a bunch of kids, 18-year-olds they pulled off the street, kids. Armed them, trained them, and sent them over to Vietnam, out of the streets of the States, and into just insanity, just absolute insanity. Warfare unlike anything that the world had seen before, at least the Western world had seen before. Nobody played by the rules. These were kids. And there was just unbelievable horrors that they were faced with. You never know whether the kid walking toward you with a smile on his face was smiling because he figures you're there to save him, or he's smiling because he's got a gun and he's about to shoot you. They didn't know who the enemy was. They didn't know where they were going to wake up in the morning, if they were going to wake up. You come off the plane. The people who were there didn't want to know your name until you'd been around for a couple of weeks because, you know, trying to live the first 72 hours in Vietnam, I don't know. It's just insanity. These kids were pulled off the street, sent into places they were not prepared to cope with, subjected to all sorts of insanity, and somehow had to find a way to survive, and they did. They found a way to cope. And the American government did a bit of testing and discovered how they were coping. They were testing their combat soldiers, their ground-level troops, and discovering, I think, somewhere in the nature of 80% of them were testing positive for opiates on a weekly basis. These kids in Vietnam were finding that they couldn't do a damn thing about where they were. They couldn't do a damn thing about whether they were live or die, but they all knew how to get rid of the terror. just do a bit of down and take the edge off. And so imagine somebody walking into the Oval Office saying, "Oh, Mr. President, we have a problem. What's up?" Remember those tens of thousands of kids that we took from the streets of America? Armed with weapons, trained to be killers, sent them overseas and gave them experience at killing? Yes? Well, 80% of them are heroin addicts, and we're about to set them loose on the streets of America. We got to bring them home. And the president just went, "Oh, boy." Or something. I don't know. I wasn't there. But I would have loved to have been. And it's funny because the American government could not spend money on addiction research fast enough in that moment. It all of a sudden went from a moral issue, this is just weak moral character, to a bunch of gun-toting heroin addicts that we created running around the streets of America. No, this ain't no moral issue. This is obviously something that we need to get out in front of. And the world of modern addiction treatment was born. And so the Americans brought these kids home, and we didn't have treatment in the way we have today. They had VA hospitals, and in the VA hospitals, they detoxed people. They took people through their issues of withdrawal. 10 days in a detox, medically supervised. A little bit of follow-up support and counseling and a little bit of, you know, conversation in the detox, but again, no addiction treatment program of any measure. And after 10 days in a detox, they were set free on the streets of America. And how successful do you think their program was at curing addiction? It was the most successful program in history. We have never had success rates that will ever come close to that. MRTC, at its absolute best, can't even begin to come close to the success they had in those detoxes. I'll get to that. They followed these guys for 3 years, and they found of all the guys who were addicted, all the guys they put through this 7 or 10 day detox, 60% of them used heroin at some point in the 3 years after they got home. What that means is 40% of them never used again. And I got to tell you, if MRTC could stand up and say 40% of the guys who walked through our front doors would have total abstinence from their substance of abuse for a 3-year period, we would have people flying in from Betty Ford, the Mayo Clinic, they'd be flying in from all over the place. Mostly statisticians wondering how we're fudging our numbers. That is remarkable in and of itself. But you know what? They said maybe somebody using isn't necessarily an indication of problem. Maybe we should ask some more questions. And what they discovered is when they asked guys, "Well, you know, so you've used since you got back from Vietnam War. What happened?" "Oh, well, about 18 months after I got home, I bumped into a buddy of mine. And he said, 'You want to go party?' And we went and we partied. And then we woke up the next day and we looked at each other and we went, 'This is stupid. We got families. We got responsibilities. We got better things to be doing.' And I haven't touched it since." And I got to tell you, if we had a guy coming out of MRTC, and that was his only experience of using for a 3-year period, we'd be calling that a tremendous treatment success. So they looked at it and they said, maybe we shouldn't be looking at how many guys use. Maybe we should be looking at how many guys use to the point where they got re-addicted. How many guys got trapped again by heroin? It's not how many guys managed to use and walk away without consequence. How many guys got trapped? 12% got re-addicted at any time in the 3 years. That means 88% of the guys who went through that detox never resumed a relationship with heroin in that 3-year period that was significant enough to have them re-experience tolerance or withdrawal, the hallmarks of addiction, which most centers like MRTC would talk about as an 88% cure success rate. Unbelievable. What's that? So give away my punchline, but you're absolutely right. No, that's fine. I mean, the final piece is, even when you look at the guys who get re-addicted, maybe the guy parties for a few weeks. The question is, maybe we should be looking at how many guys get stuck. And the best way to look at how many guys get stuck there is at the end of 3 years, who's trapped in the life? Who not only got re-addicted, but who's still addicted? Who's still caught in the life? And what they found is 6% were re-addicted after 3 years. And you're absolutely right about that. 94% at the end of 3 year period were not addicted to heroin, which is absolutely astounding. And how do we account for this? Why was it such a successful treatment program? Because unlike MRTC, most of the guys they treated weren't addicts. Most of the guys they treated just got trapped in heroin. If you ask yourself what are the best estimates of addiction in the population, those numbers range somewhere between 3 and 10%. For heroin, somewhere between 3 and 6%. This 6% number here probably represents the addicts. So what's going on? Well, it's real simple. We sent 100 guys to Vietnam. And they all used heroin to cope. And out of that 100, we had 94 guys whose brains weren't set up to get trapped. And we had 6 guys who were. We basically sent 100 kids to Vietnam, 6 of whom were addicts and 94 who weren't. And they all got wired on heroin to cope. And when they came home, we got them all unwired. And the addicts, in the absence of treatment, went back to the grind. This is probably the most compelling evidence of two things. First, you can't really talk about addiction being in the substance. Heroin is addictive. No. 94% of the people who met the criteria for substance dependence disorder with heroin were not addicted to heroin at the end of 3 years. They walked away from heroin. Powerfully addictive substance, presumably. Does heroin have a very high probability of creating a chemical dependence in someone? Absolutely. I have a friend who had a knee replacement surgery. About 5 weeks after his knee replacement surgery, he got a terrible flu. He phoned the doctor. He said, "Is there any chance this is a post-operative infection?" And the doctor talked to him a little bit. He said, "Well, when did you take your last pain medication?" He said, "Oh, about 4 days ago. And the doctor said, "You don't have the flu. You're just detoxing." He said, I'm what? He said, "You're detoxing from what?" The doctor said, "Well, you've basically been on morphine, heroin, for the last month. He said, "I've what?" Believe it or not, the doctor didn't let him know when he handed him the script for the pain medication that this was a very powerful pill likely to create a chemical dependence, and he developed tolerance and experienced withdrawal. He went through detox. And to this day, this guy won't drink more than 2 beer because the sensation it starts to create just brings him back to what it was like to detox. He fortunately is not an addict. It had the exact opposite effect. This is a guy who runs from pills, runs from mind-altering substances because the experience was just not a positive one. Many guys who we see as clients are the same guy, knee replacement surgery, who happen to have the underlying genetic predisposition. It's kind of like this guy in Vietnam. You don't know the brain you have until you have the substance. Now, why was Vietnam so important? Well, understand that Stanton Field's conceptualization of addiction really talks about a combination of situation, experience, and person. These three things have to come together to create an addiction. You need to have the kind of situation that's conducive to addiction. You need to have the kind of person with the underlying genetic predisposition, and the substance needs to create a particular experience. How many people on the planet do you think are addicted to syrup of Ipecac? Do you guys know what that is? It's a thick black liquid you find in a first aid kit. You drink it in the case of an accidental poisoning. It causes you to empty your stomach contents violently. Somebody accidentally ingests something. If you give them syrup of Ipecac, they will vomit it out, and they'll continue to have dry heaves for about half an hour. It just wrings the stomach out. And it actually rings so violently that most of it's sent this way, but some of it's sent the other way. I mean, if there's anything in your system, it gets shot out, and you're heaving for half an hour. Sounds wonderful. How many people on this planet do you think are addicted to syrup of Ipecac? I don't think anybody. Why? Well, because it doesn't create the kind of experience. It doesn't create the kind of benefit that the kind of substances that we work with do. People get kind of edgy when they hear me talking about this. What's an addiction counselor talking about the benefits of drugs and alcohol for? Aren't you supposed to talk about drugs being bad? No. Drugs aren't bad. Drugs aren't good. Drugs are drugs. Where your life goes, that might be good, that might be bad. But one of the things you really have to appreciate is that most of the guys that we work with aren't stupid. They don't do drugs because they're bad. You know, if you did a drug once and it made you feel good, you did it the next time and a body part fell off, you probably wouldn't be an addict. Probably, if you did syrup of Ipecac, hey, I broke into Dad's first aid kit. I got some Ipecac. Want to meet me behind the portable after school? It doesn't create the kind of experience that get guys trapped. Guys get trapped because their situation leads them to need an experience, and the drugs or alcohol provide that experience. And if you don't respect the experience that drugs and alcohol can create for you, how are you going to recreate the experience? If drugs and alcohol are how you cope, how are you going to cope without them? If drugs and alcohol are how you unwind, how are you going to unwind without them? If drugs and alcohol are how you get the courage to go into social situations, how are you going to go into social situations without them? I work with a client in an outpatient clinic that could not come to an appointment at our clinic unless he had a six-pack in him. His social anxiety was so pronounced that he couldn't leave the house without a six-pack in him. Talk about a bind. I need help. I need some kind of treatment. I want to go to counseling. But in order to go to addiction counseling, I have to get drunk. That's addiction. Anyhow, the criteria that tend to create addiction, or the kinds of situations, the kind of environments that create addiction. First, you have an environment that's high in fear and deprivation. Think of the Vietnam War. Or think of the downtown East Side. I'm serious about that. Environments with a loss or lack of control. When you feel like you don't have options, you don't have control in your life. A life with a loss of positive options. You think about these guys in Vietnam. No control over where they'd sleep, no control over what they'd do, but they had control over how their head was. They could choose to care about it or not care about it chemically. A lack of positive options. Well, what other options do they have? You know, we're going to sleep under the stars tonight and then run at that facility tomorrow where they all shoot bullets at us. I don't know. I was thinking I'd catch a meeting and hang out with my sponsor instead, Sarge. I don't think so. Lack of social support. Addiction thrives in isolation. And a lack of values of moderation. Live hard and die hard. And guys who subscribe to that motto tend to. So, from that, Stanton Peel has developed what he sees as the addictive criteria. How do you know when something's addictive? How do you know when something is going to be problematic? Well, they seem to need to provide certain benefits and do certain things to be the kinds of things that people can find addictive. The first thing that needs to happen is something has to be absorbing. It has to kind of draw you in and just take your experience. Things need to be predictable. One of the reasons why angel dust never really became all that popular a drug and why, you know, we were first freaked that it was going to take over the world and it didn't is because you never really knew what was going to happen. It was like playing Russian roulette with a drug. You need a predictable experience. Again, if one time you took it, you felt great. The next time you took it and something fell off, it's not going to be the kind of thing people get addicted to. It needs to create a sense of control. Or value. And again, you think about the way in which the use of substances really... Somebody comes into me and says, Wes, I'm really feeling depressed about my life. Can you help me feel better? Absolutely. It'll probably take us about 6 months, meeting on a weekly basis. And how long is their drug of choice going to take? Seconds? Maybe minutes? In a race to see who can help Buddy feel better, the drug of choice is going to kick my butt every time. And it's going to make him feel even better than I ever could. But here's the thing. To date, no one that I'm aware of has ever lost their house because of addiction counseling sessions with Wes. No one's ever had their wife leave because of addiction counseling sessions with Wes. I have yet to have a guy come to me and say, well, the boss finally fired me because, you know, I should have been at work and instead I was seeing you. I have yet to be walking down the street and buddy stopped me for some change and, come on, man, this isn't for something to eat, is it? No, I'm trying to get another session with my addiction counselor. I mean, drugs and alcohol will kick my butt every time. But if you look at the cost, what does it cost you to see me? Not much. Might take a while. But it doesn't cost you anything. What do drugs cost you? Well, it's kind of like trying to swat a fly with a sledgehammer. If you connect with the fly, it'll kill that fly better than I ever could. But often what guys find is, what does it cost them to use the sledgehammer to kill a fly? Well, when they kind of come to, they've done $20,000 damage to their place. And they've broken three windows and put a hole in the wall, and guess what? Flies are coming in. So he's reaching for the sledgehammer. You can see where this is going. It's not that drugs and alcohol are a bad solution per se, it's they're an expensive solution. Guys just can't afford the cost. Your freedom, your relationship, your career, your self-respect, your life. That's what drugs will cost you. Me? No, even in private practice, not a lot more than a cup of coffee at Starbucks. Anyhow. The next criteria, illusory. Things are addictive when they create an illusion, an illusory kind of experience. People love illusion. Disneyland is just fabulous. So, if these are addictive criteria, well, okay, heroin in the Vietnam War. Absorbing? Absolutely. In a predictive way, you bet. Give these guys a sense of control or value? Absolutely. Can control their experience. And would it create an illusion of all okay? Yeah. Tomorrow I could die, but right now I just feel like everything's okay. I don't even think about it. I could die tomorrow. Alcohol, absorbing, predictable, control, value, illusory. The internet, absorbing, certainly can be in a predictable way, you betcha. Sense of control, value, yeah, I mean, guys create like entire fictional lives that they immerse themselves in. Illusion, absolutely. The whole fictional life piece. Religion, absorbing, predictable, sense of control, value, illusory, absolutely. How about exercise? Pretty much anything that you want, you can put on that list. Almost anything can be addictive, according to this criteria. The final piece, the pieces that I've left out, the kicker, so to speak, according to Stanton Peale, is a sense of deepening or worsening. In other words, going for a run. Absorbing? Absolutely. Predictable? Yeah, I know how I'm going to feel at the end. Sense of control? Value? Yeah, I feel like I'm really taking control over my emotions, my physical health. Creating an illusion of all okay? Yeah, while I'm running, the world out there is still, you know, bugging me. But I'm not thinking about it. I'm lost in the illusion of my MP3 player and running. And deepening, worsening? Probably not. At the end of it, I'm probably in better shape than I was at the beginning. However, guy goes in to see his doctor, and his doctor says, you know what? You've blown your knees. You got to stop running, man. You keep running, you'll be in a wheelchair within 3 months. And the guy comes home from that, and he's so overwhelmed, he's so stressed, he's so freaked out by the prospect of a wheelchair, that he goes for a nice long run. That's addiction. Guy's freaked out about money. Freaked out about his wife being all over him. Freaked out about his PO's going to be all over him for what, like just freaked out about life. So he engages in an absorbing, predictable activity that pulls him out of that. He takes a break from his experience. He has an alternative experience. He does cocaine all night. When he wakes up in the morning, is it all better? No, it's worse. Started with a fight over we have no money, and guess what? He responded to that by spending $400. And so now how does he feel? Worse. So what does he do? Gets loaded. Because that's all he got. At its core, according to Stanton Peale, and I alluded to this at the beginning, addiction is just bad coping. It's one of my favorite ways of conceptualizing it. Addiction as bad coping. And one of the traps, one of the struggles, one of the reasons why guys have so much trouble in recovery, why recovery seems to involve round upon round upon round, is because often what we're asking guys to do, guys' lives have become reduced to the only way they have left to cope is to use. I'm happy, I use. I'm sad, I use. I have a good day, I use. I have a bad day, I use. Using is just how I manage life. It's my only coping mechanism. It's all I got. And okay, let's see how this works. I come to a place like MRTC, and this well-meaning guy like you says, okay, whatever you used to do to cope, stop that. No coping. No coping for you. And over the next 35 days, we're going to have you confront very difficult things without your coping. And we're hoping, if you let go of that way you used to cope for long enough, you'll learn new ways of coping. And one day, if all goes well, you'll have enough new ways of coping that you'll be able to move on with life. But you know what? Isn't that backwards? Stop coping and then just hang on, white knuckle it, until we teach you new ways to cope. Stanton Peale's piece, he says, we do it exactly wrong in the addiction field. What we should do is teach guys new ways to cope. Give guys new ways to handle the world. Give guys new support. And then, and only then, ask them to stop getting loaded. The reason we don't, my success rate at teaching guys who are loaded anything is really slim. And that's the bind. The guy used to show up drunk at the counseling sessions. I couldn't fault him for getting drunk and coming to counseling. It was the only way he could get there. But the problem was we didn't get a lot done. Until we could give him a new way to cope, we were stuck. I can't teach him how to cope when he's drunk. And he can't come learn how to cope unless he's drunk. That's addiction. So I started with addiction. It's a problem when it's a problem. Appreciate that you guys probably have some things going on for you that may be different than other people. And does it mean you're doomed? No. But does it mean you have to stick handle through life a little bit different? Probably. Probably means that, you know what, other people can run their lives in one way. You probably got to run your life a different way. So be it. You can either whine and complain about that, cope with that by getting loaded, or you can suck it up and make some different decisions about life. Is your substance of abuse a problem? No, your substance of abuse is just a substance. If there's a problem, it probably lives in you, both in terms of the thinking, the chemistry, the compulsions. And the good news is because that lives in you, the solution lives in you too. The use of drugs and alcohol is a choice. And I get that the choice that you might have to make around not using is probably more difficult than people who love you who don't have addiction will ever understand. But the good news is it still is a choice. And as long as it's a choice, you got options. You got power, you got control. Addiction has bad coping. The path out, good coping. Why do people seem to go from cocaine to marijuana? Cocaine to alcohol, alcohol to heroin, or to pills, or to this, or to that, or gambling, or sex. Well, again, because they're trading in one form of bad coping for another. They're not facing life head on. They're just hiding in a different way. And if you find a way to hide that works for you, that makes your life better, some people immerse themselves into things in compulsive ways. We call them artists and Olympic athletes. Tortured souls who do amazing things, and maybe that works for them. But for many of our guys who move from one thing to another, bad coping. The path out of it, good coping. Coming up with activities that are absorbing, predictable, give you a sense of control value, or illusory. Give you the break from your day, the way of checking out of your experience, to give you enough space to go back and take it on head on without your life being worse than when you started. That seems, for how we work with guys, to be the path out of this. We need to understand the experience, because that's what people get addicted to and what the experience offers. So understand, guys, if you struggle from an addiction, the fact that you have the addiction is not your fault. It's a natural consequence of choices you've made, given who you happen to be. But from here on out, now that you know, you got some choices to make, and we're here to help. That was a little long-winded. That was actually a lot long-winded today, but thanks for your attention. Next week, we're talking about patterns people get into in addiction and how if you continue to work them in recovery, they just don't seem to work for you. Thanks so much, and hope to see you then.